Flint, Michigan. How did a simple flip of a switch lead to a long-term public health crisis that tested the resilience of its residents? In this Science of Crime podcast series, we examine the chain of events that led to years of damage, distrust, and dirty water. My name is Anna Kim, and this is episode number 9, Environmental Racism in Flint, Raise Up Voices of Color. For the past couple of weeks, I have been actively studying the egregious case of environmental racism that occurred in Flint, Michigan, after the city's emergency manager decided to switch the city's water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River. Environmental racism is an aspect of the environmental justice and civil rights movements that is often an overthought and pushed to the side. However, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan brought it to the forefront of our discussions. Now, what is environmental racism? It is many things, but the simplest way to explain it is that it refers to how people of color are disproportionately exposed to polluted air, water, and soil, and how they are disadvantaged in environmental policies, practices, and directives because of their race. It can take on many forms, including racial discrimination in environmental policymaking, the disproportionate placement of toxic waste facilities in predominantly poor minority communities, and the exclusion of people of color from leadership roles in environmental policymaking. Environmental racism is the reason why Black children have very high rates of asthma compared to their white counterparts, the reason why 56% of the population near toxic waste sites are people of color, and the reason why communities of color often have their voices ignored when they raise concerns about their environment. When Flint, a city whose population is 57% Black and has 40% of its population living under the poverty line, raised concerns over the discolored tap water they were drinking, the government largely dismissed their worries and assured them that the water was safe to drink. I asked Professor Sullivan, a visiting assistant professor of environmental studies at Colby College, about her take on the events that occurred in Flint, Michigan.
First, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, who you are, and what you do?
Sure. So I am visiting faculty here at Colby almost entirely on accident. I actually did some research in my master's on water and then ended up doing my PhD on wildlife. But in general, the sort of questions that I'm interested in my work are around the role of science versus the role of politics, like how we integrate scientific evidence and how we integrate political evidence into our decision-making processes. And then that sparked an interest in me thinking about process and, you know, who gets a seat at the table in these bigger questions of justice and how people, you know, throughout history have been kind of systematically excluded from decision-making spaces.
Where do we see environmental racism in Flint?
Yeah, so in Flint, we see a community of color that is kind of economically disadvantaged compared to, you know, for example, Ann Arbor, which is, you know, very well off and very white, right? So a lot of times when we talk about Flint as an environmental racist, like an environmental justice issue, it's because of the fact that people in this community sounded the alarm early on that there was something wrong with the water that was coming into their homes, right? And they were just kind of systematically ignored or silenced, or in some cases, you know, actually, you know, the data was manipulated to make it look like there weren't issues where there were. And we see those sorts of patterns of behavior and those sorts of patterns of ignoring community concerns are so much greater in, you know, economically marginalized or you know, minority communities.
As Professor Sullivan explained, the voices of the people in Flint were minimized and left unheard. The residents of Flint let it be known to their government early on that there was something wrong with their water, that people were losing their hair and their children were getting sick. Yet, the government failed to act quickly and aggressively, as they probably would have if Flint's population was mostly white and wealthy. Rather, they responded slowly and antagonistically. They did not try to address the problem and even tried to hide it at first. It wasn't until a year after Flint changed their water supply that the government finally acknowledged that the water wasn't safe. Representative Dan Kildee of Flint said race was the single greatest determinant of what happened in Flint. He said, "There's a philosophy of government that has been writing these places off. Places like Flint get written off. And to me, even though those people making those decisions might not see it this way, it's hard for me to accept the fact that race is not the most significant factor." The Civil Rights Commission of Michigan, a government-appointed organization, released a 129-page report in February 2017, in which they said that although the government had not violated any specific state civil rights laws, that historical, structural, and systemic racism combined with implicit bias helped to cause the Flint water crisis. Senator Jim Ananick, a Democrat from Flint, said, "The presence of racial bias in the Flint water crisis isn't much of a surprise to those of us who live here, but the Michigan Civil Rights Commission's affirmation that the emergency manager law disproportionately hurts communities of color is an important reminder of just how bad the policy is." Now, environmental racism in America didn't just pop out of nowhere. What happened in Flint and what has happened in numerous other places is the result of a lengthy history of racism.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of how redlining and gentrification and things like that have led or have supported environmental racism?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because a lot of my students come into my classes thinking about environmental justice, and then I start talking to them about like zoning and like community planning, and it feels really boring, right? But it also is one of the most important things for understanding why we see environmental injustice, particularly in urban areas, right? So the example I always use in my class is around St. Louis, because what we see in St. Louis is these astronomical rates of asthma in children of color in the community. And when you actually like chart those rates of asthma onto a map, what we see is a really dramatic split where communities have been redlined. And what we see in St. Louis, what we see in Flint, what we see in all of these kind of urban corridors is, as you mentioned, a direct link back to these kind of Jim Crow era policies.
Historical events such as redlining and zoning has made it so that Black people are pushed into one area of town and white people into another. And then racist lending practices made land in those neighborhoods of color worth less just because minority groups live in them. The cheap land that these people live on is sought after by corporations and governmental bodies, and minority groups largely cannot resist them since they cannot access political or financial power to stop them. Historical patterns have revealed that environmental decisions are often related to political power. Marginalized communities often do not have the socioeconomic and political means to oppose large corporations. Additionally, many of these communities cannot relocate out of these polluted areas. There have been many similar examples like Flint. The one that is brought up the most is what happened in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, when Black people were confined to the most flood-prone parts of the city. The government was extremely slow to respond to the agonies of the residents after the hurricane, much like with the Flint water crisis. Instead of trying their best to fix the problem like they would have if it were a white wealthy neighborhood that was seeking help.
There was actually a low-income housing development in New Orleans that they'd been trying to shut down for years and replace with, like, you know, those like fancy McMansion houses or whatever they are. And they could never get the political mechanisms they needed to do that. And then Hurricane Katrina hit, and they used that as the excuse to actually shut down that low-income housing, right? And so all of those people who had lived there, who had built this community in those areas, physically didn't have anywhere to come back to. So that's just another kind of unfortunate, but also very clear example of environmental racism at work.
Clearly, environmental racism is a very modern day problem, especially with the coronavirus claiming far more Black lives than any other race because of pollution-caused asthma and heart disease. A place to start addressing these problems would be for Flint's policies to have more community input, rather than the residents being continually dismissed, minimized, and disrespected. They could be taken more seriously and be included in the political discussion to have a meaningful influence and say in decisions that affect their community and quality of life.
What do we count as valid knowledge and what do we not count as valid knowledge in thinking about environmental harms?
The color of people's skin or what neighborhood they live in shouldn't determine how vulnerable they are to a polluted environment. Toxic waste facilities shouldn't be disproportionately placed in poor Black neighborhoods. People of color shouldn't have to continually deal with their complaints going unheard or disrespected, and they should be offered a valid and influential seat at the political and financial table.